like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Marian Guizdala, President and CEO of Advocates for Service Animal Partners, Inc., or ASAP. A national nonprofit based right here in Tampa, ASAP is the only organization in the United States whose sole purpose is securing, protecting, and advancing the rights and responsibilities of service animal handlers and the businesses they patronize. September being Service Dog Awareness Month, I thought this sounded a timely opportunity to learn about ASAP and its multifaceted mission, which also includes providing direct support, intervention, and mediation for disabled individuals who choose to use a service animal to mitigate their disability. In addition, ASAP operates the only 24-hour national hotline to assist service animal handlers and the businesses they patronize in understanding their mutual rights and responsibilities under state and federal laws. As the person who leads ASAP, Guizdala has a wealth of experience while holding a Master's of Science degree in mental health counseling as well as additional related training. He's been blind since 1983 as a result of retinitis pigmentosa and has been a guide dog handler since 1987. Guizdala and his guide dog Trooper have joined me in the studio here at WNF for this conversation that will cover various facets of ASAP and related issues for disabled individuals who choose to use a service animal. That's all coming up when I speak with Marian Guizdala in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. A programming note, I'll be away next Wednesday, September 25th, and hosting in my absence will be Glenn Hatchell, the dog trainer and behaviorist, probably familiar from our periodic Ask the Trainer segments. A former WNF programmer, Glenn has hosted Talking Animals multiple times over the years. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Charlotte Arndt and Griffin Richardson of Seaside Seabird Sanctuary. They'll fill us in on Seaside Birding Club at Walsingham Park, a bird watching event that the sanctuary is holding on Saturday, September 28th, involving a short trek to Walsingham Park with the hope of spotting some cool wild birds. We'll learn more about the Seaside Birding Club at Walsingham Park when we talk with Charlotte and Griffin a bit later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss Advocates for Service Animal Partners, Inc., or ASAP, with its CEO, Marian Guizdala, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Marian Guizdala, Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Marian.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. You might want to get just a hair closer to the mic,
right,
or move the mic
or
closer
pull
to you.
Towards me?
Yeah, either way.
No one's ever accused me of being mic shy.
Okay, well, there you go. That sounds better. So, again, welcome to you and Trooper. It's nice to have you guys. As I said, in the studio, we don't get enough guests for Talking Animals in the studio, so I'm always thrilled when we do have one. So I feel like there's a lot to cover here, a great deal to learn about ASAP and its multifaceted mission. But before we dive headlong into those topics, it might be helpful to hear some of your story, trace the key parts of your path that led you to where you are today, CEO of ASAP. So start the story wherever you think the pivotal part begins.
Okay, well, I guess it starts around 1987 when I got my first guide dog. I've been losing my eyesight all my life. I've always been a dog owner, and when I lost my eyesight, I decided that a guide dog would be a good addition to my life and a good tool to use. So I got my first guide dog in 1987. About 2 weeks after I came home, I went to a restaurant that I frequented prior to getting my guide dog, and was told that I wasn't welcome anymore because they said, "You've come in here before without your guide dog. You don't need one, so please don't bring your guide dog back." That started my advocacy. Just a short 6 months later, it really started when I went to, on New Year's Day, I went to a bar and was told I couldn't enter because of my guide dog. And that started my real advocacy work because I filed one of the first complaints in the state of Florida for discrimination against a disabled person using a service dog. And that's kind of began my process of becoming an advocate. I worked with another organization, the National Federation of the Blind. I'm still active with them, but I led their National Association of Guide Dog Users for many years and had a lot of progress. And when I found it time to retire, and I resigned the position, and people came to me and said, look, we still need you. You do something that isn't readily available, and we'd like you to keep doing what you're doing. I said, well, you know, I want to retire. I want to move on. And somebody said, well, what if we funded the project? And I said, well, now you're talking.
Yeah. Suddenly I'm more interested. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'd be curious to know, Marion, when you first kind of described getting your first dog in 1987, first of all, what was that like? I mean, it sounded like you were a longtime dog lover, but still having gone gradually blind, sounds like prior to that or leading up to that point. What was that like when you first got the dog and all the things that initial dog afforded you, which, I mean, I know that's decades ago now, but yeah, still.
It was. And it was a very different experience because up until then, I was using the long white cane, and so I had some tactile contact with my environment. The cane touched the ground, and it alerted me to obstacles in my way. And now I, after 5-6 years of using a white cane, now I was putting it aside and relying upon a dog to guide me. And it was a little different.
Yeah.
But the dog offered me a lot of independence. It does things a cane can't do. I can tell my dog to find a door, and he'll find the door and a chair and trash cans and curbs and things of that nature, as well as guiding, something a cane can't do. So.
And I'd be curious to know, if, when you describe kind of not long after you got the dog, the first dog, it sounded like that's when you went to a place that you had been to many times and suddenly you were refused entrance. So was this long enough ago where there weren't any laws that dealt with discriminating against having a service animal in a restaurant or an establishment like that?
Well, there's the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in 1990, so this was 2 years prior to the ADA.
Okay.
However, Florida has a law that actually has a little more teeth than the ADA does. Mm. Florida has a criminal statute that says any person, firm, or corporation who denies or interferes with access to a person accompanied by a service dog is guilty of a second-degree misdemeanor. So in those cases, we're allowed to file criminal complaints, which is what I did. And when I took it to the state attorney, of course, the police officers didn't know anything about the law. When I took it to the state attorney didn't know anything about the law. And the state attorney's question to me was, if I don't know the law, how do I expect businesses to know the law?
Yeah.
And of course,
fair
my
question.
Yeah.
Really.
And my response is, well, businesses are responsible for knowing the laws that govern the conduct of their business.
Yeah.
So they need to know these laws as well, because these are a vital part of it.
For sure. So how did you fare with that first complaint that you filed?
Well, it didn't fare too well because, again, the state attorney wasn't aware of the law, refused to prosecute it. We have a lot of challenges getting cases before the courts, primarily because law enforcement doesn't know the law. And when we try to explain it to them, we're a layperson, you're a civilian, they don't listen too much to us. So we're trying to change that culture. We're working with the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. Hopefully they're going to come through and conduct a training program along with us to educate law enforcement in the state of Florida, and they can get their continuing education program hours through that. So we're hoping that HCSO is going to help us out with this.
Sure. Well, it sounds like there's reason for optimism, but I'm surprised a little bit, I guess, that in 2024, with laws that are on the books, and you said even Florida law has more teeth than the national, the federal law, that as people file complaints like you and others, that people, the DAs or whoever they're charged with handling this case, can still sort of be dismissive about it, because there are laws that govern the exact cases that sound like people are bringing. So I'm sorry to hear and surprised to hear that that's sometimes as far as it goes.
Yeah, unfortunately, in many cases, disabled people are marginalized. And when we try to defend our civil rights, have our civil rights enforced, that marginalization impacts those people who have the authority to fix the problem and intervene for us. It impacts their willingness to do that.
All right, so I'm going to have to ask kind of a crucial question, but we do have a caller who'd like to join the conversation, so maybe I'll bring them on before I ask my fundamental question here. So hi, you're on Talking Animal with Marion Guzdala.
Hi, Duncan. Yeah. Well, I'd like to make a quick comment first and then ask my question. I did a paper in 1998 while I was in college in St. Louis on the American Disabilities Act, and it said part of my research said that it was $1,000 fine for any infraction. Most of the infractions were structural, though. Like if you didn't have handicap accessible curbs in front of your building and things along those lines. But I was wondering, is there also $1,000 fine per incident with regards to service animals? And then I want to add one quick thing before you answer my question, and that is my stepfather, before he passed away, he was an attorney for the Pentagon, and I had a dog that was considered vicious at the time. He wasn't a service animal. He was just a Rottweiler who had gotten into trouble because he had bitten somebody, and I had to go to court over it. And my stepdad's comment was that certain people are afraid of dogs no matter what the size is. It's just they have a fear of dogs or some animals, I suppose, some other animals, but specifically he mentioned dogs, and that it really doesn't matter about the size of the dog. But my question is primarily, is it $1,000 fine to deny somebody use of their service animal?
Thanks for your call and your questions.
Thank you. So to answer that question first, I'm not sure what the fines were in 1998, but I believe that they were maybe much higher than $1,000, because currently the fine for the first offense, if fined, is $75,000.
Wow.
So it is quite a hefty fine. Now, then you've got to also take it into perspective, because one of the biggest challenges we're facing as service animal handlers is access to Uber. Uber is a multi-billion dollar industry, so $75,000 doesn't really mean a whole lot to them. But we have a lot of problems with Uber and Lyft and rideshare companies, so much so that many people who use service dogs thinking of not getting a dog again. So to answer the second question, though, about fear of dogs, there are people who are afraid of dogs. Both the state law, and Florida, by the way, is one of 37 states that has criminal statutes. But in the federal law and in the state law, both, it says allergies and fear of animals are not reasons to exclude a person with a disability accompanied by a service animal. And the reason for that is, one, The fear is irrational. I mean, someone who has the fear, it is a real fear. But our dogs are very well trained, and they're not a threat to anyone. And if they are, a business has a right to remove the dog. Our right as a disabled person accompanied by a service dog is not absolute. So if our dogs are not under control, if our dog poses a direct threat, then a business has a right to ask us to remove the dog and give us the access without the dog being present. So allergies and fear of dogs are not reasons to exclude a person with a disability accompanied by a service.
All right, well, that, I think, answers that. We're going to take one more call and get back to some questions that I have, hopefully. Hi, you're on Talking Animal with Marion Guzdala.
Hi. My daughter has her best girlfriend is legally blind, and she has a service dog. And she applied for a job. She went to, I don't know where it was or what it was, but she went for a job, and they told her no, because of the dog. It was a big dog, too. It was about 70-pound lab. That's a big dog, but a real sweet dog, you know, trained and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came home, and within like an hour or two, she got a frantic call back from, I guess, the manager of, where she tried to get the job. And, oh, no, come back. We want you to come back and work for us. Apparently, they know about the fines and about the law. I think probably a lot of businesses do now. And that's a good thing, because it really stinks to try to you know, keep somebody from using a service dog. They need them, you know. And yes. Anyway, that's all I got to say. I know you're busy, so I'll let you go.
All right. Well, thanks for that story. That is telling, I think.
And right? That is because there, within the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's not only access to public places, it's also access to employment. And so a business is required to make a reasonable accommodation for the service animal in a place of business.
So we've done shows over the years, Marion, seeking to address the confusion, both innocent confusion and sometimes intentionally perpetrated confusion over what constitutes a service animal. And one of those times I convened a panel discussion, including someone with muscular dystrophy living with a service dog, an activist in this realm whose husband was blind using a guide dog from Southeastern Guide Dogs, and a veteran flight attendant participating anonymously, because I think her job would have been at risk otherwise, offering numerous observations of abuses, scams, really, I think is the term we used that day, maybe, or she used, involving what appeared to her as fraudulent service dogs. So let's see if we can define what a service dog is and what a service dog isn't.
Okay, very good. Well, the definition is very... very definitive, definitive definition.
Okay, that's
very
the best
clear.
Kind. That's my favorite kind.
That's a favorite kind of definition I have, too. Yeah. It is a service dog is a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability. So the essential element of the service dog is its training. So how do you know when a dog comes into your business if the dog is a service dog or not? And it's really easy to tell because there are some questions that can be asked, and the answers to the questions are important, but also there's more to it. So let's start with the questions. First, you're allowed to ask, a business is allowed to ask, is this a service dog required because of a disability? Because only disabled people are allowed to be accompanied by a service dog. The second question is, what task or work is the dog trained to perform? Because the dog has to be trained to take an action upon some sort of stimulus. So the stimulus is I say to my dog, find the curb, and the dog takes the action of going to the curb and stopping. Now, emotional support and protection are not trained tasks of a service dog because they don't have anything to do with the disability. One, an emotional support animal is not trained, and protection is not, unless it's what they call nonviolent protection, like my dog will protect me from a car. He'll step in front of me, push me back, keep me out of the lane of traffic if that were to happen. Now, people can answer those questions the way they're supposed to, and you say, well, then what good are the questions if they know how to answer them? But the one thing that cannot go unnoticed is the behavior of the dog. Our rights, again, are not absolute. We have the right to access public places with our dogs, but we must keep our dogs on a leash or tether unless the leash or tether interferes with the work, and the dogs must be kept out under control. If it's not, if the dog is misbehaving, if it's greeting other people, if it's barking, if it's obviously untrained, don't let it in. It has no business being in public. And there is a Florida state law, again, it is a second-degree misdemeanor to misrepresent an untrained dog as a service animal. And there are businesses all over the country trying to take advantage of people's rights to be accompanied by a service dog, presenting documentation. Documentation is worthless. We encourage people, ask the questions, observe the dog, and allow the access if the dog is under control. And if it's not, you have a right to deny the access. Just like you would a parent who's got a kid who's not behaving.
So the documentation, because another thing that kind of has come up with this periodically, especially in recent years, is vests that I think you can buy for $50 or documentation that, you know, is part of that same purchase. So that to the person who doesn't know necessarily what you just laid out, how to establish the credibility, it looks like, well, this dog's got a vest, it says service dog on it, it's got paperwork if somebody even asked for that. So at that point, I guess you just have to know enough to ask what questions that you just laid out and see what the answers are and if they're satisfactory or not to determine vest or no vest, documentation or no documentation. Do we really have a service dog on our hand here?
Mm-hmm. We have a YouTube video that we just produced and released on Friday concerning this, so we can get people to watch that, and it explains a lot of what we're talking about and provides more information for them too. So.
And would that be on the ASAP website?
If you go to our website, we haven't had it posted yet. It's going to be up there. If you send me an email, advocacy411@gmail.com, I'll send the link to the YouTube video. Or you can just do a search on YouTube. It's called Navigating the Service Animal Landscape. And if you do a search on that for YouTube, it will come up.
Okay, so that sounds simple enough, and that sounds really timely because, again, I think on both sides of the equation, there's obviously still questions, frustration, just like our second caller there indicated with a friend of his daughter. Didn't get the job, and then the company or the place of employment obviously realized they could be in serious hot water and then frantically called her back. But there's just, like a lot of things, I guess, but here maybe more so, there's kind of murky situations or just lack of information that I guess that's where you come in with all the advocacy, because it's important to clarify for people what constitutes a service dog and what the obligations really are on both sides of that equation.
And if people have questions, they can always call and we can guide them through it. We do have a 24-hour hotline. It's 855-ASAP-211 or 272-855-272-7211. But, you know, here's what I advise companies. If a dog comes in, if a person brings a dog in and it's questionable and you're not really sure, if the dog is under control, let it in. If it doesn't cause any harm, don't put yourself in a precarious position. But if the dog is out of control, document it. Every one of us carries around a camera in our pocket. Open up your smartphone, take a video of the behavior and the request to remove the dog so that you protect yourself. Again, people who try to misrepresent their pet as a service dog have not put their pet through the same rigors that service animals go through. Most pets are not used to being out in public. They don't know what to do when they see another dog. I mean, I have been in stores where I've turned a corner and there's been a dog there that was not a service dog, and it has jumped at my dog. And for some dogs, my dog is a kind of a strong dog, but some dogs might be affected by that, and it could affect their training. So it's not a responsible thing to bring an untrained dog into a place where dogs are not allowed.
And you know where this harkens back to that panel I mentioned, because again, part of the panels by design, one of the panelists by design, I invited a flight attendant, just because they're especially in that period leading up to that panel discussion, there have been a particular number of news stories and photos about all kinds of animals that were on flights being passed off as service animals. Some of them were just, you know, super outrageous, like a peacock at one point and some other things. And so I guess, I don't know if it's practical, if you're boarding a flight, if it's practical for the steward or flight attendant or whoever to ask those questions or run through the protocol you just outlined for determining the legitimacy of a service dog. Because I don't know what's going to happen if that animal is going to be turned back, or, you know, it just seems like there's, but maybe that's part of why they do that, is they're kind of forcing the issue and trusting that people won't send them back.
Well, the new regulations now, though, from the FTA, is that we as service animal handlers now must complete a form before we fly.
Okay.
And the reason is because all these people who are misrepresenting their dogs as service dogs to bring them into an environment which is so unique. I mean, a lot of people haven't flown on airplanes, let alone dogs. And you put a dog that's untrained that doesn't know how to accommodate to some of these situations, you put them into a pressurized tube and you fly them at 40,000 feet. What happens to that dog at 40,000 feet when you lose control of it and it's running around in the cabin uncontrollably? There's nothing you can do at 40,000 feet.
Yeah.
The challenge, though, and the problem is that we're on a slippery slope here. Because what happens if every place I go today, I have to fill out a form before I go in to demonstrate that my dog is a service dog? We're urging the Department of Transportation to change the rule and not require all of these forms because they're very, very burdensome. I mean, we've got to give 48-hour notice. What happens if I have to fly because there's an emergency and I need to go to Baltimore to see my daughter for some reason and I need to be there today?
Yeah.
I don't have 48 hours to go to the vet, fill out a form, make sure my dog is healthy and under control before I fly.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're on a slippery slope here.
Yeah, the burden proof seems like it should maybe even be shifted in the other direction or at least somewhere in between, because it feels like you say, that a perfect example. Why should you have to fill that out each time, especially if you have an emergency flight for medical reason or some other mm-hmm. thing? And why shouldn't it be the airline or someone else saying, well, we're not sure this is, you know, right, or here's what our position is, or here's our paperwork. Just seems like it seems unfair to ask always that the service animal handler fill that out, especially if you're saying it's becoming more and more common in other instances.
Mm-hmm. So, and I do agree. There's a lot of misrepresentation, and it is more crucial when, again, you're at 40,000 feet. So I do understand the precarious position that the airlines have been put in. But it also puts us in a precarious position. And those of us who have legitimate service dogs, we're the ones paying the price for those people who misrepresent their pets as service dogs to avoid some small nominal fee that the airline might charge to put them into another area, not in the cabin, in cargo.
Another part of the plane, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I hope people who think that they can just say, oh, this is a service dog, when they don't even have a disability, just so that they can take their pet into a store where they don't belong, will think twice about this, because it compromises.
The ripple effect is considerable, it sounds
like. Yeah, it compromises the integrity of our assertions and the believability of that, and it also creates issues for others. Because my dog is obvious it's a service dog, but not everybody does. I mean, a service dog is not only a big dog. It's not just a guide dog. I mean, people who have psychological disabilities or other physical disabilities, you know, they use service dogs as well. And those dogs could be smaller, different breeds. They could be rescue dogs from a shelter. So you can't judge the person and their need for the dog based upon the dog. Ask the questions. And, you know, the law says that even if it's obvious the dog is trained, such as it's observed guiding someone who is blind, then the question shouldn't be asked. My position is ask the questions of everyone, because if you do, then you're not going to say, oh, I'm just asking it from certain people.
Yeah.
So I don't mind being asked the questions. And when they do, I say, thank you for asking. I hope you ask everyone those same questions, because that's going to cut down on it.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting thing. I'll flip it around. And so it's across the board. Everybody's really being treated and asked the same questions no matter what. And then there's just no question about what the result is. And by not asking certain people, it's not like you may be doing a bit of a disservice in a way.
Now, at one time, we had a real serious problem with zoos. We were getting a lot of calls about zoos. I mentioned the National Federation of the Blind. We worked with Zoo Tampa, and we created a training program. And since then, I have had very few calls about zoos. And that video is available on our website, right off the homepage. If we could find someone in the hospitality industry, especially the restaurant industry, because restaurants and medical facilities are the two biggest challenges we face as service animal handlers in accessing public places. And possibly restaurants, because people go to restaurants a lot. But healthcare is a very problematic area, because healthcare providers have a bias against disabled people to start with. And the National Council on Disability has done a study and found that 56% of physicians don't want to treat a disabled person.
Wow.
And then you couple that with a disabled person who has a service dog, now all of a sudden you're bringing a dog into a healthcare facility they think they're special, that the dog is going to compromise their sterile environments, yeah, and things of that nature, all of which, you know, are not necessarily true. So healthcare facilities and restaurants are the two places we currently have the biggest challenges, and the two places that we wish we could find some support to educate those industries better. So if there's someone out there who has influence in that, we'd like to hear from you.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of hearing from you, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in a bit late, my guest, this being Service Dog Awareness Month, is Marion Guzdala, CEO of Advocates for Service Animal Partners, or ASAP, national nonprofit based right here in Tampa. ASAP is the only organization in the United States whose sole purpose is securing, protecting, and advancing the rights and responsibilities of service animal handlers and the businesses they patronize. If you have questions for Marion or would like to offer a comment about service dogs or related topics, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So we do have at least a call or two that we want to get involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Marion Guzdala.
Hi, I'm double dipping, but it'll be real quick. My daughter's girlfriend has a service dog, but she always has the vest with dog, and I'm sure she has paperwork in her purse. So, you know, if people see the service dog vest on the dog and they ask for papers and you have the papers, then if they deny you accessibility, I mean, it's like justice delayed and is justice denied, you know, and I think they should have a law against any of these people that try to, you know, bring a dog in that's not a service dog. But I think if you have the paperwork and the vest, you should just cruise right on by, you know, it shouldn't be a problem.
Well, the challenge is that you can buy a vest and you can purchase the paperwork. So the Department of Justice and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which enforces the Fair Housing Act, both have said that documentation is not proof that the dog has been trained. True, it is, you know, some programs do provide identification cards and paperwork, but you know, if I have an ID card that says my dog has been trained and is a service dog, that represents one moment in time. Because 2 years from then, that ID is still there. But what has happened to the dog? Has the person maintained the training? Because training is not something that happens and then it's done. Training is something that happens all the time. When I'm out with my dog, I'm always training my dog. I'm a trainer as much as a handler, because I need to keep my dog under control and I need to let him know when he's doing a good job, reinforce the work that he's doing. But if I don't do that and the dog is out of control, that ID card means nothing. So IDs and vests, I'm encouraging businesses to not even accept them, to say, put them away. I don't want to see it. I want to know, is this a service dog required because of a disability? What task is a dog trained to perform? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Basically, those two questions and what the following answers to those determine the legitimacy of that particular...
And the behavior.
Yeah.
Behavior is important. Don't overlook
it. Oh, yeah. It goes without saying that behavior is absolutely paramount. But, okay, you've educated me. I didn't know about that, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
Appreciate it. All right, so Mary, so speaking of, you're alluding to, in a sense, their trooper, given the nature of the show, kind of, I guess, wouldn't be all that surprising. I'd love to have you walk us through a typical day, but from trooper's point of view. So how does the day begin for him relative to how it begins for you and that kind of thing? I think it's still educational in other ways, but just coming from a different angle.
Trooper's day begins when I let him out the door early in the morning to go out and relieve and feed him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty much it depends upon the day. Every day is different for me. Some days I'll be in my office all day long, get up a few times and let the dog out and go play with him, brush him, you know, give him some attention. Some days we get up early in the morning and don't get home until late at night. So... Trooper doesn't know what his life is going to be from one day to the next, because we don't know where we're going to be or what we're going to be doing.
Keeps things interesting for Trooper.
It does, and he's a very flexible dog. He doesn't. A lot of people think that blind people travel routes. Like, we go the same way to get to the same place every single time. Many people might do that. Dogs might get into a rut and follow those routes, but Trooper doesn't have too many routes he follows. He's out and about all over the county.
And what breed is Trooper?
Trooper is a smooth coat Blue Merle Collie. He is a collie by breed, smooth coat, meaning he doesn't have long hair like Lassie, and Blue Merle are his markings. He's kind of black with gray splotches. Maybe you can describe him better than me, because...
Well, he's a beautiful dog.
I've never seen him.
One of the things I said before we went on the air is that, he's not necessarily a dog that you would immediately think, well, that's a guide dog. Just because I think people think they see Goldens, they see in the old days maybe German Shepherds, they see different kinds of dogs as guide dogs. So it sounds like these days all kinds of breeds really could be considered for becoming guide dogs, just based on how they respond to the training.
Yes, and Freedom Guide Dogs is developing their collie stock. And they also, they do some pretty interesting dogs. They've done some, what's it called, a Barbet. It's a dog that is hypoallergenic for people who have allergies or allergies in their household. But program dogs are not the only service dogs out there. I mean, there's a lot of guide dog training programs. There's also service animal training programs. But individuals can train their own dog. It's not rocket science to train a dog to do work that's going to benefit you as a disabled person. I know blind people who have trained their own guide dogs.
Wow.
But think of this. If one of your challenges, one of your disabilities is that you use a wheelchair, and if you drop something, it's really hard to pick it up. Training a dog to fetch is not a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Everybody trains their dogs to fetch, and so if you use a wheelchair and your dog picks up dropped items, then your dog is a service dog.
And then it fits that criteria that you established early on. All right, let's take one more caller while we can, and starting, unfortunately, getting near the end of our time here, but we'll have some more time for a couple more questions, including this caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Marion Guzdala.
Good afternoon. I really appreciate the show, Duncan. I am one of those people that fall right in between the cracks. I have a Labrador. She's 8 years old, has lived on the streets with me homeless all her entire life. And that includes walking along streets and busy traffic. And I do break the rules in that she does not live on a leash except when we go into stores or establishments. She rides the bus with me. She has been to doctor's appointments and grocery stores and such. I do have a letter from a psychiatrist that I am under their care for PTSD and that I rely on her. Her name is Patience, that I rely on Patience. And like I say, she's lived in the streets. She's been exposed to everything you could ever be exposed to. She doesn't freak out about other dogs, like the guest mentioned, in a grocery store and coming around a corner. The other dog goes nuts. She will ignore it. She doesn't sniff at anything. She doesn't go up to people. She doesn't wag her tail when people come to her. Can I pet her? No, not in the store. Only a couple times have I ever really been asked. And in one such case, I do have a letter from that psychiatrist, and it's a grocery store, a large chain. And he asked me the other night, is that a service dog? And he's seen me in there probably at least a dozen times with patients, because we're never apart, literally. And I said, yes, she is. And she said, no, she's not. I'm like, yeah, she is. I said, I do have a letter. Now, like I say, though, I recognize the fact that I've fallen between the cracks because she's not a trained service dog for a particular service or skill. But to keep me calm and keep me from, things, so she keeps me well-grounded. And I do need her. We are never apart.
I'm sorry, we're nearing the end of our time. Was there a question you had specifically for Marion? I'm so sorry, but we're really almost at the end of our whole time together.
Is there anything in between just buying a stupid vest or something off the internet and having her fully recognized as a trained for example, sightseeing dog.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question, because, again, we're close to time, but let me ask you.
Yeah, I'll take you off the air.
What task is the dog trained to perform?
Keeping me from not freaking out in situations where...
And with all due respect... It's not a service dog. A service dog is trained to do work or perform tasks.
Right. It's a companion animal.
And that's not a service dog. And so saying it's a service dog is a violation of state law because it's not trained to perform a task.
Right. Okay.
Because that might be more of an emotional support dog, which is another category altogether. Yeah. But that sounds like it does not meet the criteria, as Marion has explained, to be recognized as a service dog.
Okay, what is the recognition of the credibility of credentials for emotional support? There isn't, that I know of.
There isn't, but it doesn't. But you don't have public access with an emotional support. The only thing an emotional support animal designation does for you is allow you to have your animal in your residence, but not in public.
I gotcha. And I've been very fortunate because my dog is so well behaved. We don't get questioned, and she's just blends in. So we really very rarely do get questioned, and I do have a letter from a...
But just the fact that you're taking it into a public place and it's not a service dog is challenging for me.
You're putting yourself and perhaps others at risk. I do have to run now, but thank you so much for your question and your information. That's just a very good discussion.
Thank you for the show.
Thank you. So we're nearing the end of our time. Let me hit the website for Advocates for Service Animal Partners. It's serviceanimals.info, if I have that correct.
That is correct. I like to say it's service animals, plural,
right?
Info, yep.
Okay. And that's for any kind of follow-up information or research that we didn't have time to address here. And in 1 minute or less, is there anything that we... I'm sure there's many things we didn't cover that we would have liked to, but that's just the nature of the conversation. We had some good callers, and any kind of parting piece of information that we should walk away from today?
Well, as we heard from the last caller, unfortunately, there's too many people who think that just because their pet provides them some sort of emotional support that they can take it in public no matter how it behaves, even if it's well-behaved, it's still not a service dog. If you have questions, if you need assistance, whether you're a business or a person, a disabled person with a service dog, and you need assistance and information, serviceanimals.info is a good place to go. You can call us. Our number is 386-ASAP-411. That's 386-272-7411 is our office number. And we have a hotline, a 24-hour hotline. It's 855-ASAP-211. So it's 855-ASAP-211, 855-272-7211. So there we go. That's a minute.
Okay, that's perfect. And Marion, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Duncan. This is a pleasure.
Marion Guzdala, and again, we thank him for coming in today with Trooper. And again, it's Advocates for Service Animals Partners, or Inc., ASAP for short, for the acronym. And again, those phone numbers and the website can be very fruitful for any further questions anybody might have that was listening and didn't get a chance. We missed a couple calls I know that we would have loved to have taken, but we're out of time at this point.
They can call me directly.
There you go.
A shout out to my wife, Mary, who's sitting out in the lobby.
Yeah, with her service dog.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, great. So in a moment or two, I'll speak with Charlotte Arndt and Griffin Richardson of... Seaside Seabird Sanctuary about this fun-sounding birdwatching event the sanctuary has organized called Seaside Birdwatching Club. Seaside Birding Club at Walsingham Park, taking place on Saturday, September 28th. And we'll hear more about this when we have them join us in just a moment here and talk. And right now, we're stepping into the Comedy Corner with Alex Edelman, who just won an Emmy, by the way, on Sunday night with a piece called Coco with a Gorilla. In today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Can I have a round of applause if you've heard of Coco the Gorilla? Huh. A few of you guys clapping, some of you not. Coco the Gorilla, for those of you that don't know, is a gorilla that speaks fluent sign language. And in 1999, this is true, Coco met Robin Williams. And last year, they told Coco that Robin Williams had passed away, and Coco went, Coco friend, Coco sad. Which is sad, but on the plus side, how funny was Robin Williams that even gorillas were like, this guy is unbelievable. Have you seen Jumanji? It's a little offensive to us, but still. My comedy hardly works if you're not a Jew from New York City. Robin Williams crossed the species barrier. Second of all, and obviously, did they have to tell the gorilla? That Robin Williams had passed away? She wasn't gonna catch it on Twitter or anything like that. Someone made a conscious decision to walk into a gorilla enclosure. Just like... Hi, Coco. Can you put down the banana? We have some bad news. And they tell Coco, and Coco's like, oh no.
That was Alex Edelman in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Coco the Gorilla, taken from a performance at the Just for Laughs Festival. Now it's time to do the Charlotte Arndt and Griffin Richardson of Seaside Seabird Sanctuary to get the lowdown on this Seaside Birding Club at Walsingham Park event on the horizon for September 28th. Here's Charlotte and Griffin on Talking Animals on WM. Good morning, Charlotte and Griffin.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
Great to have you guys here on the show. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Of course, we're glad to be here.
So let's start, if we could, by maybe asking you to provide a brief overview of Seaside Seabird Sanctuary. What is it? Where is it? And what is its chief mission?
Yeah, so we're located on Indian Shores, right where it meets Reddington Shores. And we are on the property that used to be Suncoast. We took over in 2016, and our main mission is rescue, rehab, and release of native species of birds. We take in between 3,000 and 7,000 birds every year as patients, and we also have over 100 permanent resident birds that cannot be released due to injury or disability. So we care for them. We do a lot of educational programming with them as well. And we're real excited to be a part of this community and really grateful that we have a community that supports the native birds so much and helps us to do what we do.
Okay, great. That sounds really good. And for those who might find this helpful, what's the best protocol to follow if someone sees an injured seabird or one that otherwise appears to need help, how they might kind of solicit your guys' assistance in this regard?
Yeah, of course. Good question. So anytime that there is a bird that you see that might be injured, the best thing to do is going to be to call someone who knows birds and is going to be able to give you an answer on the best next steps to take. If you are in our area and you are in Pinellas County, typically we'll be able to give you advice. Our phone number is 727-391-6211. And you can always give us a call. What will happen is you'll get an automated text message, which will ask you for what kind of bird is it, can you send us a picture of the bird, and where is it. And from there, we'll be able to give you advice. A lot of times there are birds that seem to be injured or acting strange, but they're really just fine. And sometimes there are birds that really do need help. So giving us a call, we'll be able to give you some advice on what the next best step is.
That sounds great. So tell me about the Seaside Birding Club. I gather this is something new?
Yeah, this is new. We're starting it this fall. We're really excited, and we're looking forward to seeing how it goes. I'll let Griffin tell you a little bit about the plan for this, not this Saturday, but Saturday following.
Okay, great. Hi, Griffin.
Hi. So next Saturday, the 28th, we're going to be doing a bird walk at Walsingham Park. So we're going to meet at Seaside at 9 a.m., and then we're all going to go over to Walsingham at around 9:30, and then we'll stay there until 11:45, and then we're going to come back to Seaside to wrap things up.
Well, that sounds great. What kind of birds do you anticipate seeing?
We're hoping to see some blue jays, black and white warblers, eastern towhees, definitely some wading birds of great egret, and ingas, pink blues. Hopefully we'll see some some eastern phoebes and some frassata cherries and all sorts of songbirds and wading birds.
That sounds great. Wow. Sounds like it's going to be a bonanza of birding there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. September to November is the prime migration period, so we have a lot of birds that aren't typically here that cross the blue. So it's really a neat time to get out and see the different kinds of birds that are out there.
That's very cool. So if people were interested in getting involved, is there like a way to register or sign up, or how do people get involved on this event on the 28th?
That's a great question. So we do have it up on our Facebook and also on Eventbrite. So if you just go into your web browser and Google Seaside Seabird Birding Club, it'll pop up on Eventbrite. And you can click there to register. You'll see there's two options. You can register for free, and you can also register and make a donation via registering. So we have that open right now, and that will be open until that day, so you can register all the way up until the day of the event.
That's great. And the event starts at 9 a.m. at the sanctuary, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah, we'll do just kind of a quick introduction, get to know everyone's name, a couple of birding etiquette things. We also have some bird guides that we have for sale in our gift shop on campus, so people have the opportunity to go in and take a look at those if they want to.
And I assume people should, if they can, should bring binoculars for that kind of an outing.
Yes, binoculars are helpful. They're not required, but if you want to get a better view, close-ups or some really, really neat pictures of the birds, they are very helpful.
Well, that's great. This sounds like it's going to be really fun, and it sounds like you guys are going to do other events like this subsequently, if I understand this.
Yeah, so we'll continue this. It'll probably be every week or every other week. We're going to see how many folks are interested and go from there.
Yeah.
But we also have a bird book club starting in October, and on October 27th, we're having our Halloween Spooktacular celebration here at the sanctuary, and we're inviting everybody to come to that.
You got to love a good spooktacular around Halloween time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Well, this all sounds really exciting, and a lot of great events are happening over there at Seaside Seabird Sanctuary. So thanks for joining us and filling us in on kind of what's going on and some of the upcoming events. That sounds really fun and exciting.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us, Duncan.
You bet.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, we shift back to music programming with Jim Bannon holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., at which point our terrific Wednesday night block of Latin music kicks in. So that's all coming up just a moment or two here on WNF. So we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Next Wednesday, again, I'll be gone. Glenn Hatcher will be hosting the show, and I'll be back here on October 2nd. Invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for archives and podcasts of all our past shows and links to social media, signups, and all kinds of other stuff. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Brandon Clearwater Largo, Wiki Watching.